From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the connection between Al-Qaeda and the diamond trade, blood diamonds mined and sold by warring factions in Africa. We talk with Douglas Farah, who broke the story shortly after September 11th while he was the Washington Post bureau chief in West Africa. Death threats against him forced him to leave that position, but he's continued to investigate the funding of terror networks. It's the subject of his new book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. After becoming a surprise bestseller in England, a book about punctuation has become a bestseller in the States. We'll talk with the author, Lynn Truss. She says that with email and text messaging, punctuation is an endangered species. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. There's the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The medical staff at a military hospital in Germany is treating U.S. contractor Thomas Hammel. He escaped yesterday from kidnappers in Iraq. Kyle James reports from Berlin.
Thomas Hammel was captured by Iraqi insurgents on April 9th when the convoy he was driving in came under attack. Hammel was taken hostage and later threatened with death unless U.S. troops pulled out of the city of Fallujah. Hammel, a former dairy farmer, had come to Iraq from his native Mississippi to drive trucks for a subsidiary of Halliburton and make money to pay off debts. But on Sunday, after Hammel heard the sound of passing U.S. troops, he pried open the door of the room where he was being held and ran out to flag down the patrol. Despite his 3 weeks of captivity, the U.S. military has said that the 43-year-old Hammel is in overall good health, but a gunshot wound to his left arm might be infected. Hammel has arrived at the American Military Hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, for medical examinations. For NPR News, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
U.S. military officials in Iraq say seven American officers have been reprimanded because of mistreatment of inmates at a prison in Baghdad. Six members of the U.S. military police are also facing criminal charges for the abuse, which allegedly included prisoners being photographed naked in humiliating positions. Mark Garlasco, a spokesman for Human Rights Watch, told the Associated Press that accountability for the abuse must be taken to the highest levels.
Here it just seems like we've got much of the same, so it's really not enough to put a reprimand. We're talking about war crimes here.
President Bush has ordered Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to punish anyone guilty of abusing Iraqi prisoners. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he'll modify the Gaza withdrawal plan that his Likud party rejected in a referendum yesterday. But allies said the prime minister would not retreat from his policy of unilateral separation from the Palestinians. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jerusalem.
Public opinion polls show that many Israelis support pulling settlers and soldiers out of the Gaza Strip. It puts Sharon in the position of having more support from the country at large than he has from his own party. Sharon's Likud handed him a stinging defeat Sunday in a referendum on his initiative to evacuate Gaza's 21 Jewish settlements and the Israeli forces in place to protect them. Opposition Labor Party leader Shimon Peres said the vote showed that Likud was not fit to govern because it was thwarting the popular will. Palestinians reject Sharon's plan completely, saying the status of Gaza must be decided by negotiation. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 88 points to close at 10,314 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 18 points to close at 1938. This is NPR News. Investment banker Frank Quattrone could face more than a year in jail after a federal jury convicted him on all three counts of obstructing justice during a criminal investigation of his bank, Credit Suisse First Boston. Prosecutors said Quattrone urged staff members to destroy records after he learned that the investigation was taking place. He's scheduled to be sentenced in September. The Georgia Supreme Court has overturned the 10-year prison sentence of a black high school athlete who had sex with a younger white student. Susanna Capilouto reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
A year ago, a jury acquitted 18-year-old Marcus Dixon of rape, but he was convicted of aggravated child molestation after he had consensual sex with a 15-year-old girl. Under Georgia state law, the football player received a 10-year mandatory sentence for the offense. The state Supreme Court ruled that Dixon should have been prosecuted with the lesser charge of misdemeanor rape. His attorney had argued that Georgia's minimum sentencing laws amount to cruel and unusual punishment. Dixon has claimed he was targeted with the law because he's black and had sex with a white girl. His case drew protests from the NAACP. Dixon had sex with the girl in a classroom after school. He was an A student with a scholarship to Vanderbilt University. It was revoked after his arrest. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
The U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia is urging U.S. citizens to leave the kingdom following Saturday's attack on an oil contractor's office. The attack left five Westerners dead, including two Americans. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 10 points to close at 1117. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Home Video, presenting The Last Samurai on DVD. Tom Cruise stars as a soldier who joins a band of samurai warriors to save the heart of Japan.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Western intelligence agencies are still trying to figure out all the ways by which al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups are funded. My guest Douglas Farah uncovered an important piece of that puzzle, al-Qaeda's connection to the diamond trade in West Africa, more specifically blood diamonds, diamonds which are mined and sold by warring factions in such places as Sierra Leone, Liberia, and the Congo. Farah broke the story in the Washington Post a few weeks after the September 11th attacks. At the time, he was the Post's West Africa bureau chief. As we'll hear, threats against his life forced him to leave West Africa. He then joined the Post's investigative team. He's now on leave from the Post and is a senior fellow at the National Strategy Information Center, writing on national intelligence matters. He's continued to investigate the funding of terrorist groups. His new book is called Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. You were stationed in West Africa for the Washington Post at the time of September 11th. And after September 11th, you say you were wondering how you would find a connection to the terrorist attacks, how you could make your reporting relevant. Well, you certainly did find a connection very shortly after September 11th. And this story started while you were meeting with one of your sources, Sindor Reeves. What did he tell you that made you realize his story might be connected to al-Qaeda?
Well, he began describing to me a safe house in Monrovia, Liberia. Cinder Reeves is a relative by marriage to President Charles Taylor and had been in Taylor's inner circle basically his entire life. And he worked as an aide-de-camp for some of Taylor's senior people. And he began describing to me a safe house he had rented in Monrovia for Arabs and how they had pictures of bin Laden on the wall and how they watched videos of suicide bombers. And when he came over, they'd want him to watch the videos with them. And he asked what Hezbollah was. And I thought, for a person who'd spent their entire life in the West African bush, where you don't get much international news, it was a curious question. So I asked him why, and he said, well, because they watch these Hezbollah videos, and they cheer when the other people get blown up. Subsequent to that, and I filed that information away sort of in my head, and I subsequently heard from European intelligence sources that senior Hezbollah members had been in West Africa on both a fundraising mission, and they have several R&R places there where they go to sort of rest and relax because there's a very large Lebanese community. And so after 9/11, when Newsweek magazine and other magazines printed the most wanted terrorist mugshots, I was going to see Cinder again further down the road, and I took that along thinking that maybe some of the senior Hezbollah people on that list would be recognizable to him. I thought it was a long shot, but, you know, why not? And he looked at the pictures of the people I pointed out, and he said, no, I haven't seen any of these people. And we went on with our meal. And at the end of the meal, when I was paying the bill, he sort of flipped the page over to look at the rest of the mugshots, and he sort of went pale, and he said, I know these people, and he pointed to three people there. And I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, they were buying diamonds from me. I was with them. And so I said, look, you know, it's a little far-fetched. I don't know what to do with this, but tell me everything you can remember. And that sort of launched the investigation, made the initial tie to Al-Qaeda, which then I was able to verify through other meetings with people who dealt directly with them.
So what was the connection between your source and the three men who he was able to identify from the FBI's list of wanted terrorists?
Well, Singer goes by the name of CR, and he was very close to Taylor personally, and he President Charles Taylor of Liberia personally, and Taylor ran the diamond trade for that region. CR was also the aide-de-camp for General Ibrahim Ba, who was the gatekeeper on the diamond deals for President Taylor. And so he was asked by Ibrahim Ba to take these gentlemen, both first to meet them at the airport when they arrived, take them to meet President Taylor, where they paid a large sum of money for the opportunity to have a franchise in the diamond business. And then in December of 2000 into early January 2001, he took them, drove them from Monrovia into Sierra Leone, into the diamond fields of Sierra Leone, so they could cut specific diamond deals and buy diamonds from the Revolutionary United Front, which was the rebel group fighting in Sierra Leone. It was a group that was controlled by President Taylor.
So the three men he identified were with Al-Qaeda?
They were identified on the FBI list as, all three were identified as high-ranking Al-Qaeda officials, yes.
So you were able to piece together some of the story about how Al-Qaeda invested in diamonds instead of in banks for a lot of its money. Why would Al-Qaeda want to buy diamonds?
Well, after the embassy bombings in 1998, when Al-Qaeda bombed the two East African U.S. embassies, the United States cast around for something to do in retaliation, and they didn't have a very good handle on what to do, and they began freezing assets of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It seemed like a futile gesture initially, and then they discovered that the Taliban had deposited $220 million in gold in the U.S. Federal Reserve System, so they were in fact able to seize a large chunk of money that really hurt the Taliban. People who dealt with the Taliban extensively said the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, after that, realized, as any good group will do, that this was a horrible mistake and they weren't going to repeat it. So it seems that in anticipation of attempted freezes after the 9/11 attack, they began taking their money out of banking systems and traceable mechanisms and putting them into commodities, because diamonds are very small, they're very easy to transport, they don't set off metal detectors, and dogs can't sniff them. You can sell them easily virtually anywhere in the world back into cash if you need them. And so they made a concerted effort to draw their money out of banking systems and ways, places that where assets could be frozen, and into commodities where they could be hidden.
And they bought diamonds through a kind of underground black market system.
They bought blood diamonds from Sierra Leone and Liberia, and possibly some other places as well. They also engaged in the tanzanite business in Tanzania, as some Wall Street Journal reporters documented, including Danny Pearl before he was killed. They went into areas of the world that are gray areas or stateless areas. To understand the context a little bit, Charles Taylor, when he became president of Liberia, essentially turned that country into a functioning criminal enterprise and controlled the diamond trade of West Africa from there, with the intent of eventually taking over more territory and expanding his financial empire. So they were able to deal in the gray areas of the world, the stateless areas, where criminals exercise a great deal of influence. Taylor also dealt with Russian organized crime, Ukrainian organized crime, Balkan organized crime. Al-Qaeda were certainly not the only ones there.
Not to sound too stupid here, but blood diamonds is a word for diamond, like diamonds in the illegal trade.
I'm sorry, yes. Blood diamonds are diamonds that are mined by illegal groups like UNITA in Angola when that was going on, by different groups in the Congo who use diamonds to finance their activities, by the Revolutionary United Front in Sierra Leone. These countries were banned from selling diamonds on the international market, but they obviously continued to do so with great quantities of diamonds. Those illicit diamonds that were funding really gruesome and horrible wars came to be referred to as blood diamonds.
How did the Al-Qaeda operatives exchange the diamonds for money? Where would they go for that?
The money went to, first to Antwerp, which is the diamond center, the premier diamond center of the world. Belgium exercised at that time almost no control over people bringing diamonds in. Anyone who had diamonds could go there and sell them because it was such a lucrative business that they didn't want to get in the way of their business community being able to carry out this multi-billion-dollar trade. So you could come in with diamonds and declare them or not declare them, and it really didn't matter. So initially, a lot of the diamonds went there. Then it seems in the latter stages, they took the diamonds straight to Lebanon through Lebanese middlemen.
Why Lebanon?
Because they have a vibrant diamond trade. It's closer, and I think the people who they were dealing with, the middlemen that they were dealing with, were from Lebanon and had connections there.
So a lot of Al-Qaeda's diamond trade started before September 11th and maybe even funded the attacks on September 11th?
Well, I think there were two phases to their diamond operation. If you look at the history of Al-Qaeda and what's on public record from the trials of some of the Al-Qaeda people, including Wadi el-Hajj, who is Osama bin Laden's personal secretary, he was arrested in 1998 and tried. And his diary and phone books were introduced as evidence in New York in his trial, which no one paid much attention to. But if you go through there, there's a huge number of diamond dealers and jewelers in his phone book for whom he has personal home phone numbers and that sort of thing, including diamond dealers in the United States. And if you look at his notebooks, he wrote extensively about how to analyze diamonds, how to set up a diamond mining operation, how to do many different things. There's a page in there that describes Liberia. It says Liberia. It has phone numbers. It has prices for diamonds. It describes deals done. So that was prior to the 1998 move into West Africa. They were clearly interested in diamonds. There was also recently an imam from Senegal who was expelled from Italy for being tied to Osama bin Laden. And when he was asked if he actually knew bin Laden, he said yes. And they said, why did you know him? And he said, well, when bin Laden was in Sudan, he was funding my diamond business selling West African diamonds in Belgium. That would put it at least to 1996. So it seems to me that there were two phases. The early phase was to make money. They were doing a lot of different businesses, Al-Qaeda was, to fill their coffers. And then after as 9/11 approached in the 8 months prior to 9/11, they went on a buying frenzy that was clearly not designed to make money. They were paying premium prices for diamonds as a way of transferring their money into commodities to keep them from being frozen, and it was not a money-making operation at that point.
So that was just a way of not being detected.
Yes, and I was talking to diamond dealers that summer, and they all were saying they couldn't buy diamonds. Somebody was buying all the diamonds from the RUF, and these were traditional buyers who had been in business for many years. And this was one of the first inklings I had that something was wrong in the diamond trade. But obviously, we didn't know it was Al-Qaeda at the time, but somebody was buying up the entire lot of diamonds, something that had never happened before. And that was a clear indication I was later able to prove came from the Al-Qaeda purchasing.
My guest is Douglas Farah, author of the new book Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. He's the former West Africa bureau chief for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Douglas Farah. He is a Washington Post reporter currently on leave from the paper. He's now with the think tank, the National Strategy Information Center. He's also the author of the new book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. Shortly after you started investigating Al-Qaeda's connection to the diamond trade, you had to flee your post in West Africa because there were death threats against you. How did you find out about the death threats?
I was fully anticipating that President Taylor, who has a long history of brutality and killing of people who get in his way, would be upset about the stories. I honestly felt that if things would calm down in a few days, if I was just able to sort of stay low and lie low and stay out of the way. But a couple of days after the story ran, a regional security officer from the U.S. Embassy asked me to come down to the embassy, and I knew it was important because he said to come down Sunday morning at 9 a.m. He showed me, as he's required to do by law, a threat assessment cable that said that there were credible threats of retribution against me for the story. My initial inclination at that point was just to travel someplace else for a while, do something else. But I have a two-year-old son, a son who's two at the time, and my wife was pregnant. And a couple of days later, the very next day, European intelligence sources called the Washington Post and said there are credible threats, they're going to kill him, get him out of there. At which point we decided that my simply traveling to another country was probably not sufficient precaution. And so, unfortunately, we weren't able to get an airplane out right away. The flights were rather limited at that point, so we had to wait a few days that were somewhat tense. And then I asked the U.S. Embassy security to escort us through customs onto the airplane, which they did, and for which we were very grateful, and sat there with us until the airplane was about ready to leave, and we suddenly found ourselves back in the United States.
Now, you weren't in Liberia at the time that President Taylor issued his death threat against you. Would he have had the power to send his people to where you were in Ivory Coast?
He had very close ties to the military in the Ivory Coast, yes, and that was one of the things that made it very alarming. I also heard from another source after this happened that the decision had been made not to kill me but to plant drugs on me and then take me off to prison and, you know, beat me up and keep me there for a long time, which was not a very appealing prospect, which is one of the reasons why we asked the U.S. Embassy folks to accompany us to make sure that I didn't suddenly end up with 2 kilos of cocaine in my hand luggage that hadn't been there when I started out. But yes, he has a great reach across the region and very definitely into the Ivory Coast military at that point.
Well, let's get back to the story that you were investigating and a story you remain interested in, which is the connection between terrorists, well, the underground funding networks for terrorists. It's not just Al-Qaeda who was using diamonds to invest in. You found Hezbollah was doing that too.
Hezbollah has been there for many years doing this. In fact, one of the fascinating things is that there's a deep Lebanese connection into Sierra Leone that goes back to the 1930s. And during the Lebanese Civil War, all sides of the war were being funded by Sierra Leonean diamonds. In fact, and the Speaker of the Lebanese Parliament, Mr. Biri, is Sierra Leonean born and had, and his family is back there. The diamond dealers who were served as intermediaries for Al-Qaeda belong to the Amal Militia and Hezbollah and have family all across there. It became such a concern to the Israelis, this funding, that the Israelis sent in diamond buyers to undercut the Hezbollah diamond buyers and try to take that source of income away from them. What's fascinating is what happened there in Sierra Leone and Liberia and in the Congo is that they ended up doing business together. So you have Hezbollah and Israeli diamond dealers doing business with each other who will happily explain that the war is back home and business is business here. So I'm not sure how much that succeeded in undercutting the Hezbollah money connection, but I think it's probably spread the wealth a little further into the other areas of the region.
And do you know if Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda are still using diamonds as a way to keep their money hidden from intelligence agencies?
The most recent information I have comes from the U.S. military, who remain convinced that this is an ongoing operation, that in some form they're still trying to acquire diamonds. They've been much more receptive to this story than other intelligence agencies have. And they're putting a great deal of effort on the ground in West Africa now to try to cut off the trade that they believe is ongoing.
Another way that terrorist groups have gotten around using the banking system is by using the Hawala system, which is, why don't you explain what the system is?
Well, it's something that also is extremely widespread in Pakistan, India, and the Arab world. Chinese have a variation of it called different things, which the United States intelligence services were virtually ignorant of. There were a few people who had actually studied this and tried to raise the alarm about Hawala before 9/11, and they were not given any attention whatsoever. Essentially, what it is a method of moving money without ever actually moving money. Most of the people who use the Hawala system are Pakistani or Indian laborers who work in the Arab states. As you know, for example, in the United Arab Emirates, only 20% of that population is native to there. The rest are imported workers from other parts of the world. So they send back literally hundreds of millions of dollars in remittances back to their families. But the banking systems in Pakistan and India don't work very well, and they charge high fees, and they can't get the money to their family, let's say, in rural areas. So this whole system of hawala is used for that. So you can go to someone in UAE and say, do you have delivery service on the border region of Pakistan? If the person doesn't, he'll find someone who does. But essentially the hawaladar, the person running the hawala, will call up his brother-in-law in whatever, or send him an email or fax him, whatever area of Pakistan this money is going to go to, and say, look, Douglas Farah's sister needs $500. She's going to come. Her code word will be juice. When she says that, give her the $500. So that my sister gets $500 with a flat 1% or 2% maximum fee, and it's delivered within a matter of days. When my brother-in-law in Pakistan needs $500 worth of milk, he'll call the hawaladar and say, I need $500 worth of milk. I'll buy that for him in, let's say, Dubai, and I'll ship it to him. No money ever changes hands. There's no transaction that happens. He gets his $500 worth of powdered milk. My sister gets her $500 worth of cash that she needs to survive. And essentially, records, when they're kept, don't tell you who your clients are. It tells you who the person on the other end is, or what relationship, vague relationship they have, and they're destroyed almost immediately. So you have literally billions of dollars moving across the globe, but mostly in that region of the world, that are completely untraceable. And the hawala performs a vital function, because people couldn't, feed their families left at home without that type of service. So closing that down is also extremely problematic.
Has the hawala system been affected by the attempts of intelligence agencies to track al-Qaeda money?
There has been an attempt both to track how hawala money moves and to regulate them, and I think both are probably destined to failure, because if you over-regulate them, they simply become like banks and the system crashes down and people stop using them. If you require registration of the underground economy, it will either drive people further underground or put them out of business, so you also have a problem with that. The only way to really get at this, I think, is to talk to hawaladars themselves, enlist their support. There's a small network of people, and one of the things that are relatively small, and one of the fascinating things is that they don't allow each other to default on money deliveries. If I can't deliver and I said I would, other hawaladars will pay that client, because the whole system is run on trust. And often, if I default, refuse to pay, I'm not physically beaten. I'm simply ostracized from the community, which is also a very high price to pay in that society. So it's an honor-driven system where people know each other. And I think, as in most of the financial war on terror, the only way to really get at it is with much better intelligence on the ground, and regulatory efforts, I think, are largely destined to failure.
Douglas Farah is the author of the new book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by TIAA CRAF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, counterfeit T-shirts, coupon fraud, and stealing baby formula. More with Douglas Farah on the funding of terror networks. Who would have thought that a book about punctuation would become a bestseller in England and the U.S.? We'll hear from Lynn Truss, author of Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Douglas Farah, author of the new book Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. He first started investigating how terrorist networks are funded after September 11th, when he was the Washington Post's West Africa bureau chief. He's now on leave from the Post and is writing on intelligence issues as a senior fellow at the National Strategy Information Center. In looking into how terrorist groups are funded, you also write about some really odd schemes, like using counterfeit name brand clothing, T-shirts, things like that. Talk about what you found there.
There have been, going back at least to the late 1980s, a whole raft of schemes that different terrorist organizations have used to raise money. None of them raise much money at a time, but over time they've raised tens of millions of dollars through these systems. One of the favorite ways is through coupon fraud. They simply collect coupons out of unused Sunday newspapers or out of trash dumps, make them look dirty, send them in, and then collect to the coupon issuer as if they have been turned in to buy goods, and then the company will send back those rebates to that particular store. And what you saw happening in one case in New York and New Jersey was that stores that traditionally did maybe $300 a month in coupons were suddenly doing $15,000 a month in coupons. This was traced to the blind Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who engineered the World Trade Center 1 bombing in 1993, this particular operation. But the investigators couldn't get anyone to pay attention to the terrorist ties there. It's really stunning if you go back, as I did, and read the transcripts of some of the stuff that was said and talk to the early investigators. Nobody wanted to hear about it. If it wasn't drugs at the time, if it wasn't big enough, they didn't want to hear about it. And these were all pretty much small-time scams. Abdul Rahman also ran a scam to make knockoff T-shirts for the Olympics with it had Nike or Adidas on them as if they were the genuine article. So instead of selling them at $20, they would sell them at $10. The T-shirt might cost them $2. Inking them up might cost them another dollar. They busted warehouses of this stuff before they actually got onto the market, which would have had a value also of $7 million, which were also traced to the blind Sheikh. And again, no one was able to put the pieces together or realize the significance of that. One of the Hezbollah schemes that was recently discovered was taking cigarettes from North Carolina, where the tax is very low, trucking them to Wisconsin and other states where the taxes are very high, selling them and making huge amounts of money. They made several million dollars doing this, stealing baby formula, getting people desperate for drugs or drink to go in and steal cans of baby formula and then repackaging them because it sells for a fairly high price, and selling them to other stores as wholesalers. Any number of things, credit card fraud, it's a huge, huge business. And it's fascinating to look at how well-structured and well-thought-out these operations have been and how long they lasted before anyone started paying attention, which was, you know, almost 20 years.
Now, you're very critical of the CIA in your book in the sense that you think the CIA could have found out a little earlier about the funding mechanisms of al-Qaeda, about their connections to diamonds, about their use of the Hawala system. What could they have done, do you think, that they didn't do?
Well, I think there are two aspects. One is I don't fault them for not understanding what was happening on the ground in West Africa prior to 9/11, because they essentially had no assets there. When the Cold War ended, the embassies in Africa or the stations in Africa, which were largely used to recruit Soviet diplomats who were serving in embassies abroad, were essentially slashed to the bone. What I do criticize the CIA for is at the time they had the opportunity at different times to follow the blood diamond trail and the arms trail in the months prior to 9/11, and they chose not to because it was not a high priority for them. I think if you look at the financial side, that wasn't so much the CIA as it was the other investigative agencies that could have been following that. There was, for example, a small group in the Treasury Department who were talking about the use of gold, the use of hawalas, the use of what they were calling non-formal transfer mechanisms. It's kind of a cumbersome name, but there was a little group looking at this very actively for funding terrorism in 1999, and the group was essentially disbanded because they were told their work was not appropriate, not necessary, not high priority, get on and do something else. If you read the reports that that members of that particular little group wrote, they're extremely timely, and in 9/11 it would have saved us a lot of time in trying to figure out how financial mechanisms worked if we had gone back and read those things, which were written several years earlier, or had paid attention to them.
Was this Treasury Department group that was investigating the Hawala system stopped during the Clinton administration?
Yes, it was during the Clinton administration.
And it was stopped on whose order?
On the order of the director of FinCEN. A new director had come in and wasn't interested in having them pursue that. He wanted to go back to monitoring bank transactions and the more formal financial structure. And so it wasn't a formal group. It was a group of people, one who had an expertise in gold, one who understood Hawala, one who understood the black market peso exchange and the gold and the drug business. And they just began comparing notes and put together a program for studying this. And they were told to knock it off and take all their data out of the Treasury computers, completely scrub them of all that, because it was feared that it would lead to racial profiling or other things.
What's your analysis of the conflict between, you know, not wanting to engage in racial profiling and also wanting to go after certain Islamist groups that seem to be tied to terrorism?
I think it's a very, very difficult line to walk, and I think that inevitably as you go after charities and Islamic institutions that may have been tied to terrorism or Islamic institutions that may be tied to the Muslim Brotherhood, you run a risk of alienating the entire Islamic community in this country, which is a real tragedy. I think that, again, you need to be extremely selective and have really good intelligence. And as the 9/11 panel is showing, the FBI simply didn't have the intelligence on these groups and didn't try to develop them and didn't analyze the intelligence they did have relating to these groups. And so after 9/11, there was a huge reaction, oh, my God, we have to do something. And so they essentially swept up everything they possibly had without being able to discriminate between what was real and what wasn't real. And I think that that has done a tremendous amount of damage within the Islamic community, where a large majority of people are obviously not interested in waging war against the United States, and where most people, when they give their zakat, which is the equivalent of the tithe in the Christian community, 2.5% of all their business transactions, want that money to go to good causes. They don't want it to go to terrorism. But in the rush after 9/11, I think a lot of things got swept up that shouldn't have been.
You were describing earlier about how you had to leave your position as West Africa Bureau Chief because there were death threats against you after you started investigating the connections between the illegal diamond trade and Al-Qaeda's funding. When you returned to the United States, the CIA asked to meet with you because you had come to know so much about this form of funding the terrorist network. And you did meet with the CIA. Is it a kind of no-brainer for you that if the CIA asked to meet with you as a journalist, you'd say yes? Or what are the standards for deciding, like whether it's appropriate to meet with them or not?
Well, I think it's an extremely dicey proposition, and I had never done it before. Unless I was seeking information or wanted to confirm information that I had, I would give them specific information, ask them if they could help me track down the veracity of this. I felt in this case, while I couldn't go into the sources for the story at the time, that it was extremely important to tell them as much as I could, because I felt that another terrorist attack could be imminent, that we understood very little about their financial structure, and that if I could explain to them why this story was credible, it would be helpful perhaps to them in tracking down and being able to stop future attacks. The same thing happened with a colleague of mine from the Wall Street Journal in the Tanzanite story, who for the same basic motivation went and talked with them much more and gave them much more information than I think either of us ever had in our, I think we each have about 20 years of being foreign correspondents, than we ever had, you know, in the past. But it was mostly driven by the sense that this was a whole different era and we could actually save lives perhaps by doing this.
Are you glad you did it? Would you do something like this again?
I think my experience with the CIA left, I would say, a very negative impression on me. As I describe in the book, at one point they came to me and they had said to me repeatedly, if you have credible sources, we'd like to talk with them. At one point, CR, who was related to President Taylor, as I said earlier, and was one of the main sources on the initial story, his life was in danger. He wanted to get out. And so through intermediaries, I asked the CIA if they'd be willing to talk with him, and they seemed very, very interested. And essentially, I go into a lot of detail in the book on this, they set up a lie detector test that was designed to discredit him and prove that he was lying. And their reasons for this were that they were afraid of the information I had on his previous contacts with them, warning them about the diamond trade and other information that had come to them several months earlier about weapons for diamonds deals that they had chosen to ignore. And what one source told me after all this had happened was that they wanted to discredit him so that they could say, as Congress was inquiring and they were getting hit by outside government bodies demanding explanations, that my source had been polygraphed and was found to be not credible. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, I talked to several congressmen. They all pulled out the same letter from the CIA, which said, you know, we've polygraphed one of his main sources and he's found to not be reliable. So I think in retrospect, I certainly would never hand over another source of mine to them. And I would be a little more careful in what I shared with them.
You recently testified to a congressional subcommittee, and you told them that you still don't think enough attention is being paid to West Africa and its connection to terrorism.
I think there is a slow realization that, in fact, the gray areas of the world, as I mentioned earlier, the Liberias, the Congos, the Sierra Leones,
the anarchic failed states.
The failed states across Africa present a safe haven and necessary infrastructure for terrorists to operate. I mean, one of the things Taylor was able to do, he didn't do with Al-Qaeda, but he did it with other criminals, was grant them diplomatic passports. He let Victor Boot, who was the world's largest illegal weapons dealer, who dealt not only in Sierra Leone and Liberia and Angola, but with the Taliban and the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, he was allowed to register all his airplanes in Liberia. He had a fleet of 50 aircraft that were flying around the world delivering weapons that were creating havoc everywhere, with no inspections, no nothing. So if you have a state that you have access to, where you have the trappings of a state, which really mask the criminal enterprise, is extremely beneficial to terrorists. I think, in my experience, the military, the Pentagon, has been much more aware of this and is moving much more aggressively to deal with and try to understand these gray areas than the rest of the intelligence community.
Douglas Farah, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Douglas Farah is the author of the new book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. Coming up, One Woman's Love Affair with Punctuation. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Truss describes herself as a punctuation vigilante, and that might sound like just the kind of person you'd like to avoid. But her book, which promises a zero-tolerance approach to punctuation, became a surprise bestseller in England. It was just published in the States, and this week it's number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book was an outgrowth of a BBC radio series she did on punctuation. She's also worked as a literary editor and TV columnist for the Times of London. She now reviews books for the Sunday Times of London. Her book about punctuation is called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. Why do you care so passionately about punctuation?
Well, I think I've always cared about clarity as a writer. I've always been... I've written for many years, and I was an editor on newspapers and magazines before that. And so my whole life really has been about trying to make the words on the page do what the writer, or I as the writer, intended. And punctuation is such a big part of that. It's part of the printing tradition. It's not so important in the electronic technologies. But as far as print on the page is concerned, putting that comma in the right place is terribly important. And I notice as a reader, I always read things with a pencil in my hand. I take out bad punctuation. I put in what I consider to be the right semicolon. It's just such a terribly important thing that communication is always as clear as it can be.
Do you repunctuate things that have already been published that you're reading?
Yeah, I do. As a book reviewer, usually, and then I struggle with whether or not to mention in the book review that I thought that the punctuation was bad. And I a couple of years ago I reviewed a book that had so few commas in it, and in the review the woman had written quite a lot about her divorce, and I said, oh, obviously the husband got custody of the commas.
Is there a good example that you could use on radio of how the wrong punctuation totally changes the meaning of the sentence?
Well, there's a nice one that's quite well known, which is a set of words which is a woman without her man is nothing. If you just have that with no punctuation at all, I think people probably would all say, how profound, without really bothering to see whether they've read the same thing. Apparently, if you put this up on a blackboard and ask women to punctuate it, they will punctuate it differently from men. Men will put a woman, comma, without her man, comma, is nothing. A woman, on the other hand, will probably say a woman, colon, without her, comma, man is nothing. So, you know, even with the words in the right order, you really do need that helpful punctuation.
Let's talk a little bit about the comma. Do you think that any guidelines about the comma have changed since you were in school and beginning to learn punctuation?
I know that personally I use fewer commas than I ever used to. I think there is just a general drift towards fewer. I will often not always put them both, you know, around a subordinate clause if I think that the sense is okay without. One of the things that as writers and editors, everyone knows is that the conflict you can have with a copy editor over how many commas to have, it's you can never guard against it. People just have very, very different feelings about how many commas to have. I think broadcasters and actors like to have lots of commas because they need to have the guidance about breathing.
Exactly. I find I punctuate differently for the radio than I do if I'm actually writing something, because on the radio, like you said, I'm putting in pauses. I'm putting in like stage directions about where to take a breath, where to pause or hesitate. Whereas on the page, it's different.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. The origins of punctuation. I mean, all the origins.
It's not completely
of writing.
It's not completely different. I don't want to overstate that.
No, I'm sure, but the origins of punctuation, you know, are from, you know, in the origins of writing before printing. Writing was to be read aloud. It wasn't for silent reading on your own. So it was for the head monk or whatever was going to read from a manuscript of the Bible. And so the marks were in there to indicate to him, like musical notation, where to pause and inflect and so on. With printing and the rise of silent reading, you have a different function for punctuation, which is mainly to illuminate the grammar. And those things are always slightly in conflict, I think, especially with commas.
Well, one of the things you bring up here is that although there are rules of punctuation, there are disagreements about those rules, and really educated writers will disagree. A writer will disagree, an author will disagree with the editor about where a comma should go or isn't necessary. So that makes it kind of interesting, but it also makes it very imprecise. People think that punctuation is right or wrong, and there's a whole kind of gray area in between.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, I wrote about, you know, I called it the zero tolerance approach. The only thing I'm really zero tolerance about is apostrophes, that putting apostrophes in before an S in a plural, in the plural of lemons or something. That's definitely wrong. Using a singular possessive instead of a plural possessive apostrophe, that's wrong. But when you do get into commas, that's when it gets more interesting in a way, but it is certainly very hard to lay down hard and fast rules. You can imagine what the editing of this book was like. The process was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. Because even though clearly the book was about my opinions on punctuation, my editor had different opinions on punctuation, so we had to compromise a few times.
That's really funny, though. I mean, because after all, the book is supposed to be about your opinions on punctuation. So those must have been interesting little skirmishes.
Oh, I was very discouraged. After a while, I thought, oh, I know nothing. But we did have I had two different editors who, of course, had contradictory ideas too. So having reluctantly accepted one editor's ideas, I would then have them challenged by the next editor who supported what I'd done in the first place, unknowingly. So it just goes to show that I know that people do want hard and fast rules, and there are hard and fast rules about, as I say, about apostrophes. But I do think in a lot of other cases, it's better to use your common sense than to and to use your ear. And to, you know, just listen and think about what the meaning is if you put that comma in or if you leave it out.
My guest is Lynn Truss, author of the bestseller about punctuation, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lynn Truss, author of the bestseller Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, the Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. As you say in your book, some people use a lot of semicolons. Some people really are not fans of the semicolon. Some people like to use dashes. Other people are not fans of dashes. Where would you place yourself on the scale?
I suppose I do err on the side of the dash, probably. But I love semicolons. I think they do... The analogy I draw in the book is that semicolons and colons just give you this, it's as though you're sort of floating on air in a sentence, and a semicolon and a colon just wafts you up again. You know, you get another wonderful thermal, you know, takes you along. And I think they're terribly elegant and marvellous marks. And I think a dash doesn't do that. A dash is much more prosaic, down-to-earth kind of mark, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't promise anything, a dash. You know, you start, you know, you've heard one part of a sentence, you get a dash, you have another part of the sentence. And it could be related to what went before, but it might not be. It might be completely unrelated. Semicolons, when you have a semicolon, that is a promise. There is a promise involved in the semicolon that what you're reading next will be related to what you've had before. And a colon is a real firm promise it's going to explain what went before. It's going to illuminate what went before. And I didn't really quite understand about colons, I think, before I worked on the book, and I now think they're quite marvellous. I use an example in the book which anyone who knows anything about English football or soccer will, I hope, appreciate. It's to demonstrate the difference between colons and semicolons. So without either, you have Tom locked himself in the shed, period. England lost to Argentina, period, which is just two statements that you know, that's all, they happened in the past. That's all you probably know about that. Then if you say Tom locked himself in the shed, semicolon, England lost to Argentina, that's, you know, that suggests that there is some connection between these two events, but they're both in the past. But it could be that, you know, Tom locked himself in the shed, England lost to Argentina, the rabbit electrocuted itself by biting into the power cable of the washing machine. Then you have, with the colon, Tom locked himself in the shed, colon, England lost to Argentina. And then you know Tom locked himself in the shed because England lost to Argentina. So I think it's if you can sort of handle that, it really helps. You can do more subtle things, really, with writing if you only ever use periods, or as we call them, full stops. You can't suggest connections between thoughts, which that's mainly what you want to do when you're writing.
Let me ask you to explain the title of your book, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves.
Well, it's a joke that someone told me while we were making the Cutting a Dash programs, and it's a joke about a panda who goes into a bar and he orders a sandwich and he eats a sandwich. And then just as he's about to go, he gets a gun out and he fires the gun. And they say, why? You know, why are you behaving like this? Pandas don't behave like this. And he shows them a wildlife manual and his entry. And it says, panda, large black and white bear-like mammal, native to China, eats, comma, shoots and leaves. So obviously, normally a panda eats, shoots and leaves. But if you put the comma in, he behaves in a very un-panda-like fashion.
Yeah, that's a great story. How did you learn punctuation? Did you learn punctuation in school, or did you kind of figure it out more independently?
I think when it really came together for me was when I first left university. I started work as a sub-editor on magazines and newspapers, and I think that's when it fell into place for me. I think I knew what all the marks were when I was at school. And I think I was always corrected. I think we were always, even if we weren't taught it particularly, I do remember that our, certainly if I put an apostrophe and it's in the wrong place, that would be crossed out until I got it right, which I think is something that isn't really done anymore. So, but I think it was really when you're sitting down to edit something written by a professor of history at Cambridge or something, that you feel, I really ought to know what I'm doing here about subordinate clauses and so on. Actually, the story about Thurber, I remember the Thurber and Ross stuff, reading The Years with Ross when I was a very young editor. I remember being at my desk and reading that story and telling everybody about this marvellous story about Ross needing a comma in After Dinner the Men Went into the Drawing Room. You have to have a comma after dinner because it gives the men time to stand up and push back their chairs, which is such a great story. And I remember finding that when I was about 22 years old and reading it to everybody because I thought it was just so charming.
Lynn Truss, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was lovely.
Lynn Truss is the author of Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, presenting The Last Samurai on DVD. Tom Cruise stars as a soldier who joins a band of samurai warriors to save the heart of Japan. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bob Edwards on his new biography of Edward R. Murrow. We'll also talk about some of the changes Edwards expects in his life as he makes the transition from hosting NPR's Morning Edition to becoming a senior correspondent. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.